All right, and we're back. This is episode 14 of Sleep Time's Over 1994 Year in Review, where we attempt to talk about and review every single major label album that was released in 1994. I'm your host, Sky Cameron. And I know we're playing some Digital Underground now, and a lot of people, you might be saying, well, this didn't come out in 1994, but as you guys may have known, we are mourning the loss of iconic Bay Area artist, producer, rapper, musician, Gregory Jacobs, aka Shock G. And I just decided for this episode, let's bump up a Bay Area one that I had kind of, you know, saved for later, and let's do it right now. You know, just as a dedication to Shock G, a dedication to the Bay Area, the Yay area. And I have a very special guest today that's going to be filling in for my regular host, Aaron Sakai. He's an amazing DJ. He's a longtime friend to the show and a Bay Area native, so he can speak on it. We got DJ Drama in the house.
Yes, I'm here.
What's going on? What part of the Bay are you from, man?
San Francisco, the Mission. I mean, if we're going to get specific.
Right.
22nd and Shotwell.
All right.
Right across the street from Hawthorne Elementary. And before we really dive into this more, Shock G, but then we also got a RIP to his counterpart, Humpty Hump, too.
That's right.
It still amazes me how people still think they're two different people sometimes.
Yeah, a lot of people did. We thought when we were a kid, when he first dropped, we all thought they were two
different people. I for damn sure was that one. Like, how come you don't see one or the other or both of them in the video at the same time? Like, what's going on here? And then you just later learn on about the genius musically, because like you said, he was a producer also.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't really know all of that completely until I really started reading the credits and the sex packets inserts. I don't know if kids know about CD inserts nowadays.
We read those liner notes like crazy.
But
we fiends.
I was one that used to love to read the credits, and when I learned, like, literally, he's kind of like, I won't say a all-in-one, you know, type of dude, but to be that hands-on with the project and it sounding the way it did,
absolutely,
that's where you give legendary status
to. Oh, for sure. And adding all of the vocal, not only changing his vocals, doing different personalities,
yes,
but being so musical.
Yes.
And playing multiple instruments.
Yes.
He was like a junior George Clinton.
Yes. I was really about to say that too. Because if you listen to a lot of Parliament and then you kind of listen to Digital Underground stuff, there's a lot of key elements in the music that you can reference back
to
that 70s funk.
But he wasn't straight jacking beats.
No.
Yeah, he was taking the kind of the foundation of what Parliament and Funkadelic was doing and built on it. And
yes.
Yeah.
A lot of it, even not too much sampling, a lot of original production, like especially the bass lines. Like, that's the key in funk music. That bass line's got to be gritty. It's got to be hard. It's got to, like, touch the bottom of your feet sometimes.
Yeah.
And when you hear Humpty Dance, that's kind of like the type of bass line that I'm referencing to, even on same song.
Right.
And this is stuff in the 90s. We're not even getting into the golden era part where they get into the mid-90s. They say all that stuff. Like, we're getting to the transition of the decade, going from the 80s into the 90s, and they was bringing that sound.
Yeah.
Incredible, yo.
He's very underrated.
Yeah.
Very underappreciated in the mainstream.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a shame that some people consider him a one-hit wonder when he's totally not a one-hit
wonder. So true.
Yeah,
so true.
Let's who was the first Bay Area artist you got into or you remember getting into back in the day?
This might be a name that maybe a lot of my Bay Area heads might know, but a lot of people might know. It was a dude named Tab Doe. T-A-B-D-O-E. He had a song called Jake the Fake. And they used to always play the video on California Music Channel,
all right,
CMC.
Right.
The homie Chewy Gomez.
Yeah, Chewy Gomez.
He used to host that. So I used to, like, we used to bump that song like crazy. Even, you know, of course, the obvious was Short and
Too Short
and Spice One and
Paris,
Conscious Daughters.
Right. And there was, they had the guys that Dangerous Dame.
Oh my gosh! So now you really
can't forget Dangerous Dame. We can't forget Richie Rich.
Can't forget Richie Rich.
Another Oakland legend.
Even you know before we jumped on, I was bringing up stuff like Herm Lewis and the West Coast Bad Boys compilations. Right. But Tab Dough, J to the A to the K to the E, the F to the A to the K to the E. I can't even remember what year that was, but I know it was early 90s. But that would have been the first artist that I kind of, like, we were really bumping on the regular. Yeah. Like, something that we would wake up in the morning and first thing pop and tape in the tape deck. Yes, we're going back that far with cassette tapes on this show.
Right.
And that would be wake up, and I would listen to that. Also, you know, JT the Bigger Figure and the Get Low Players.
What a sound. And for doing that out of their home.
Yeah.
Making these albums out of their home, releasing them independently, and then getting the attention of major labels at that time because they were selling so many copies in the Bay.
Yeah. And that was the one thing that I... Because, you know, I was out here in Hawaii in 94, but I still had a hell of homies back home, so they were keeping me always up to speed on what was going on, and I just thought it was so amazing at that time when, you know, New York was pretty much the dominant force, if we're talking, like, where the magnifying glass was over the hip-hop culture at that time. The Bay Area literally had its own scene that a lot of people, like, if you weren't in the Bay, you wouldn't really know about.
Right. And every sub-region district had their own flavor.
Exactly.
Sacramento.
Oh, yeah.
Vallejo, yeah. East Palo Alto.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody had their own vibe.
Even at that time.
No region sounded the same.
Sacramento had Brother Sacramento Lynch Hung.
Sebo,
too.
X-Rated.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah, man.
East Palo Alto had Totally Insane.
EPA. At
that
Black time,
Jack,
I
Black
think.
Jack.
Was the murder capital of the world.
Yes,
at that time.
It was.
Yeah.
And you had a rapper called Chunk, who I don't know.
That's right.
Chunk.
No, I do
Chunk
remember
was hard.
Chunk.
Breaking him off of Chunk.
Yes.
That
yes.
was hard.
Oh, man, you're bringing back memories right
so,
now.
So, speaking of bringing back memories, you're from Frisco.
Yeah.
I'm playing an iconic Frisco artist right now, JT the Bigger Figure. And I want to just paint the picture. In 1993, Frisco was bubbling up. It was bubbling at the time. The only artist that had really blown up on a national level from San Fran at that point was Paris.
Yeah.
You know, his debut album, he toured with Public Enemy.
Yeah.
He was like the West Coast Chuck D
in
a lot of ways. And then we had a Spice One, but he never would say Frisco on a track. He would always say East Bay.
Yeah.
He would never claim it, but he had a gold album in 92. And then you had like guys like Ray Love, who was fired, Get My Money On.
Yep.
You had IMP.
Oh, man.
Ill Manner Posse, which... Legendary.
Yes.
I mean, you had Coognut and Andre Nicotina. We knew him as Dre Dog back then.
That's right.
And we're going to talk about a major Frisco group, RBL Posse.
Oh, yes.
So, now, when we talk about RBL, RBL is so pivotal to, like, San Fran blowing up, right?
Yep.
And while playing the first song that really blew up, it's Bammer Weed. Remember the first time you heard this?
I was actually smoking some Bammer Weed the first time I heard this. Oh, this is a classic though, man.
This song was, it actually like got played on like hip-hop radio mix shows across the country.
Yeah.
It exposed a lot of people to Frisco.
Yeah.
And I argue that they were the first group that was actually rhyming about Frisco and rhyming about streets in Frisco.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because Forte came out with Forte's Back in 92.
That's right.
But this, it didn't blow up like this.
No. There was also another group, because, you know, I grew up in the Mission. Total Devastation. They had a song called Many Clouds.
Yeah, Many Clouds of Smoke.
Shout out to all my hogs. Hog status was major at that time.
Great album cover. With the cartoon cover with the Golden Gate Bridge in the back.
Yes.
And
also, you know, I also want to shout out, you played JT the Bigger Figure a little while ago. I got to shout out my dog Mind Motion.
Oh.
Because he was one of the DJs that helped break that on KMEL.
Yeah.
Because that became probably one of the most requested songs in the Bay at that time.
Oh yeah.
So shout out Mind Motion once again. Like, that's pirate DJs all day. Like, it's like my big brother. Like, he was one of the DJs that was keeping me up to speed on Hawaii stuff at that time. Like, I wasn't even a DJ yet. Like, right. I just knew hella people out there. Like, I'm just listening to this RBO, man.
It's bringing back all the memories, right?
It is, man. Like,
so, this track came out in 92, really was being played in all the cars by, you know, 93. People were getting hyped for their sophomore release.
Yep.
And we're talking about all sophomore albums now that were released in 1994 by Bay Area artists. And so there was a lot of hype for Black C and Mr. C to come up with something hot.
Yep.
And if you remember the first album, Lesson to Be Learned, he was doing a lot of samples. And this was the album where it took him to another level as producer,
where he
was playing with those keyboards. The album's called Ruthless by Law. This is, again, the RBL Posse. It was released November 15th, 1994 on In a Minute Records.
Mm.
And it was the duo of Christian Matthews, a.k.a. Black C, a.k.a. Black Chris, Black Caesar, and then Kyle Church, a.k.a. Mr. C, rest in peace.
Rest in peace.
And third member Ricky Hurd, a.k.a. Hitman, also rest in peace.
Right.
So this group originates from the Hunters Point neighborhood of southeastern San Francisco.
Yeah, if you used to go there now, it definitely doesn't look like what it did this when they was making music back in the 90s. It's totally night and day compared to back in the 90s.
Right.
Harbor Road, especially. Whew, you couldn't drive down Harbor Road if you wasn't from there back in the day. But from what I remember, like, out here, because I had got the cassette sent to me.
Right.
Surprisingly, there was a lot of people in Hawaii that knew RBL.
Yeah.
Especially off of the Bammer Weed song.
Right.
So then when you know, Jelly's got the music and all that, like, you pretty much could ride around Waikiki and hear Bluebird.
Oh, yeah.
Bumping out of CRXs at that time.
Oh, yeah. The drop CRX.
And Suzuki Samurais, too.
So this was the first single, Bounce to This. And you can even hear that this is definitely influenced. Black C took a lot of influence from L.A.
Yeah.
And he had more of a G-Funk influence.
Yeah.
And you just hear with this bass line, with the synthesizer here, it's very G-Funk.
Yeah, it is.
And no one really sounded like this in the Bay at this point. Everyone had more of a mobbin sound, mobbin sound.
Yep.
And Banks had that more funky.
Oh, man.
But this was like in itself. RBL had its own.
Yeah, no. And that's what separated them out of, I kind of want to say, the pack at that time. Because there was a lot of talent, not just out of San Francisco, but out of the Bay in general. But if you could stand out amongst all those giants in your scene and then take it to the national stage, it just shows how good the music was. And listening to it now, like, underappreciated, seriously.
Black C is a straight-up Frisco legend, for sure.
Yep.
You know, a lot of people don't even know, you know, Black C was a former gang member. He actually lost his eye. He only had one eye. Yep. A lot of people didn't know that. He had lost it in a drive-by shooting in 88. And he originally started off as a solo artist, producer, and was introduced to Mr. C through a mutual friend. I don't know if you remember this rapper, T-Lo.
Yeah.
T-Lo, also out of Hunters Point.
Wow.
And T-Lo was dating Mr. C's sister.
Okay. And so keep it in the family.
Everybody knows everybody down there. And the musical chemistry gelled, obviously. And then Black C felt, well, if I got Mr. C, he can rhyme. I can concentrate more on my beat making.
Yep.
I can rap with him, but, you know, he was like, I don't have to have it all on my shoulders.
Right.
So, and do you remember what their original name was? This is crazy. I read this in an interview. They called themselves the Hit Squad. And then,
wow.
This is before they even dropped anything. This is when they were still in the studio, like, making tracks. And then he said they heard a cut with EPMD and Parrish Mew, the only Hit Squad, and they're like, oh, we gotta change the name.
I didn't even know that.
And
wow.
T-Lo gave him the name Ruthless by Law. And then Black C just condensed it to the RBL.
Right.
So that's how they got their name.
Wow. I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
And another fun fact, Don't Give Me That Bammer Weed made it to number 16 on Billboard rap singles charts.
It was major.
I never knew that. It was the highest charting single from a San Francisco artist at that time, besides Spice One with Welcome to the Ghetto.
Right, right.
So the album, regional success. And then you mentioned Herm Lewis. They would release the song I Got My Nine.
That's right.
On the Herm. Right. And this was one of the hottest songs on that Herm album. We had a cousin from the Bay that brought the Herm compilation to us over here and exposed us to everybody. He had Sugar Bear on there, IMP.
That's right.
Right, Young Selsky.
Oh, man, Cold World Hustlers.
I mean, it was incredible. And it got me super hyped for Bay Area music. But this was 93. This was... So I think the buzz in Hawaii and the hip-hop fans was so word of mouth.
Yeah.
And tapes are getting passed around.
Yeah, and that's what it was at the time. Because I know a lot of the music I was getting from the Bay was on bootleg tapes and stuff. I don't know if the kids can relate to what we're talking about right now, but you know, that's how you was getting music at that time. Because if you was to go to places out here, you know, they would really get what was most popular at that time. Like, if you wanted to really find like underground Bay Area stuff, like you either had to know somebody there, or you know, you got to be there to really understand the culture.
Or read the liner notes, then you know which producers to mess with.
True that.
And if you flip it around, that's how I discovered San Quentin, because I flipped the San Quentin album. I was like, oh, JT produced this whole album?
Yeah,
okay, I'm going to get this.
Yeah.
Right, Messy Marv, and all these guys, right?
And so, even like out in the Bay at that time, like, you know, the amount of artists that were coming out just in the Bay, like, that's why, like, when people want to talk about this independent scene and it's better to go independent, like, the Bay had that formula.
Way before, yeah.
Way before people were even talking about it.
And Master P got it from other people.
Yeah.
So let's not get it twisted.
Yeah.
Master P wasn't the first one to do this. He just made it the most successful.
Exactly.
But, you know, he moved out from New Orleans to Richmond, saw the way these guys were hustling.
Yeah.
And then was, like, started his own label. And that was what everybody did. Everyone started their own label.
I believe Jive Records was the first label that invested into Bay Area artists.
Yep. Too Short, Ant Bank, Spice One.
Dangerous Crew.
Totally.
So let's give a shout out to Jive, even though there's a lot of artists that were under that label.
And a lot of people got jacked.
That's what I'm saying. Like, people aren't really too happy when you say that, but
yeah.
we're using this for historical references. So Jive Records at that time, even didn't Souls come out on Jive?
Souls was on Jive, right. That's,
so they had they had investment into the underground hip hop as well as all that gangster stuff that was coming out. So just the Bay in general. The Bay in general. I'm just like, I'm walking down this history lesson with you today, man. I'm just being blown away right now.
Cause I just wanted to bring back memories, you know.
It really is, dog. Like, I'm getting really tongue twisted just because I'm remembering stuff I was doing with homies while we were listening to all of this. It's just taking me way back,
that's
yo.
That's great, man. Well, this is a listen to my creep from the album, and you can even see, like, he was a hip hop fan. He's like, they said, booming in your Jeep.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Black C was a student of the game. Like, he really listened to a lot of artists. He actually cites his favorite producer of all time, Cold 187, from Above the Law. He said that was his biggest influence.
Wow. Black Superman was my cut too. Yo.
Exactly.
But also, that since you're touching on that a little bit. It is amazing that people in the Bay Area, you know, like, they weren't just stuck on stuff that was regional.
Right.
Like, a lot of Bay Area folks were knowledgeable about music, just hip-hop in general. You know, like, you could go to L.A. and people only wanted to listen to L.A. stuff. But in the Bay, like, they were well aware of what was happening on the East Coast.
Oh, yeah. They paid attention to everything.
Even down there in Texas. Even stuff that was down south at the time that wasn't so like what the South is now. But that's why the Bay gets so much love the way it does, because they always respected artists no matter where they were at. You know, you didn't have to be from the Bay Area to get that kind of love. If your music was dope and it was original and you were true to the game, that's where the love was coming from.
100%. So, what do you think the Source gave this album? I always ask Aaron this on the show. What do you think the Source gave this album in 94?
The RBL album?
Yeah.
four mics.
They gave it three.
They gave it three.
I think they robbed that one. I think this is a Bay Area classic. I think there's not a lot of skips on this album. I think it's a pretty tight album.
And especially if you're kind of like putting it next to the first album, because that's what you want to do. You want to see growth.
Yeah.
And not just with production, sound wise, because sonically from the first album to this album,
super evolution. Yeah.
Exactly. Like you could tell they had a budget.
Right.
They was able to get it mastered.
Right.
The first album sounded like it was just mixed. Man, this one brings back so much memories, too.
So, I would say I'd give this album 3.5 to 4 mics now. Just being that it holds up, and it's a classic from the area.
That's my test.
Yeah.
Can we listen to it 20 years down the road, and does it hold its weight?
I can still bump this now, and as exactly. Aaron would say, I can still play this and live my best life.
Exactly.
So, shout out to RBL. All right, next album we're going to go with another classic one, also from... Now, the Fillmore District of Frisco. We're going to do two back-to-back Frisco artists. And we got to talk about
this one,
Anthony Forte. We got to talk about Rappin' Forte.
Yes.
Now, the first time most people heard of him was that verse on Don't Fight the Feeling.
Yeah.
From Too Short's album.
Yeah.
Back in 88, the Life is Too Short album, which, oddly enough, was his fifth album by 88.
Yeah, that sounds about right. That sounds about right.
That was wild that he had his fifth album by 88.
Yeah.
And Too Short just released album this year with
Short,
E-40.
Short was on Jive too. That's right.
That's right. So Forte was, that song was popping. You remember that song being played in all the cars and everything?
Dog, even like, I was talking about JT the Bigger Figure song hitting radio. When this hit radio on KMEL, like an explosion just happened in the Bay because, you know, at that time it was you know, you take pride in the artists that come from where you're at, and if they make it, you know, to the mainstream, like that's just a super accomplishment. The way this hit radio, I mean. It was such a movement that went on because, you know, of course everybody's going to say, oh, you know, it's not the greatest song and, you know, lyrically this and that. But you just got to look at the time.
Yeah.
And when hip hop, you know, we're going early 90s like that. It wasn't stuff like this that was being played on the radio.
No.
You got a lot of tone down, right. You know, kind of like what it is today. It's got to be watered down for the radio. This came out.
And we're post-chronic era, so we're in the middle of death row.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So this is changing stuff. We still recording? We got a cat on the table, y'all.
he's a fan, too.
But the album was called Don't Fight the Feeling. It was released July 26, 1994 on Ragtop Records.
Mm.
And Ragtop was owned by... Frankie J, that was Forte's homie,
right.
And mentioned in a lot of songs. And then a lot of people don't remember that. Then he got signed to Chrysalis Records, which was Gangstar's label.
That's right.
And they distributed the album, and that's what really helped, you know, expand the reach of this record across the country. The music video as well, but
also Anthony, shout out Drake for biting the lyrics on this song.
Yeah, they actually paid Forte $100,000 for that, those three bars or whatever he stole, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, he got arrested in '91 for a marijuana charge, which is wild now because it's legal, right?
Totally.
And he did almost a year in jail, and that's what postponed his first album, Rappin' Forte Is Back. He released that in '92. It sold okay, right? I kind of remember a little bit of it, but it was this one that popped it off.
Yeah.
And blew him up. And a lot of people don't remember the second single. Do you remember the second single?
Oh, yes.
I'll Be Around.
Yes.
And I can't believe they could afford this spinner sample back then. Did they give them a deal on this? Like,
well, I mean, because at that time, like, sampling was a little easier to do.
Yeah, and I think also artists didn't know how much to charge.
And maybe because, like, this was, like, regional. So, you know... They kind of weren't given like full attention, you know, at that time, unless it blew up in a certain kind of way. So you were kind of able to fly under the radar till you got to a certain point.
Absolutely.
You know, Sub says this all the time in the studio. Just, you know, put it out. Just wait till you get that letter and then deal with it later. And that's kind of literally probably what happened with this situation. Because, you know, it came out, of course, the hoods is going to bump it. But
right.
Once you start getting outside of the city and then outside of the state. Because I want to say, like, folks down in Kansas City, like Missouri, people in Texas.
This is the ultimate cookout song.
A lot of people were playing this outside of the Bay Area region.
Right. This is the album, like, the album blew up, you know, it sold over, like, 250,000-300,000 copies. You know, he was performing, doing live. He was touring with TLC and Naughty by Nature.
You know, at that time, you know, let's not undersell that, man. You're doing a quarter of a million in sales.
Yeah.
We're not talking streaming. We're not talking downloads. We're talking physical sales.
Yeah.
At that time, that's a big accomplishment.
This was one of the biggest selling, two biggest selling singles out of Frisco at that time. So a lot of people don't even know this made it even higher in the charts than Players Club. But Players Club has more cult status.
Yeah.
But this song made it to number 5 on Billboard Rap Singles.
Wow. I didn't even know that.
Yeah,
wow.
Players Club made it to number 10 on Billboard Rap Singles. So do you have any other fond memories of this album? I just love this album. I still listen to this album.
I mean,
I'm going to play Dank Season with
a lot of pimps I knew back in the Bay. That was their favorite album.
He had the pimpish flow. He had that. He had a fine line of like being appealing to the older crowd.
Yeah.
And the younger crowd.
Yeah.
And he had one of the best voices. So, you know, Forte will go on to release 2 more albums on major labels. For the Heart, he had Off Parole with Chrysalis in 96, For the Hard Way in 97. Then he'd just go back to doing his independent thing.
Yeah.
He's still a legend in the Bay. Released 8 more solo albums. Here's a fun fact about Rabin Forte. His cousin is Sugar Free from Pomona.
No.
That's his cousin. Isn't that wild?
I didn't even know that. Wow.
So
yeah, that's wild.
The pimpin' runs
exactly,
deep in the family. So I don't think The Source reviewed this album, but if you had to give this album a mic rating back then and a mic rating now, what would you give this one?
If we're doing back then, I probably would have gave it 3.5. Just because the explosion that was going on at that time, you know, and it's not a, you know, we can go fast forward to all these years later, like it is 4 to 5 mics worthy, just because how it birthed a lot of artists that came from the Bay. And if you listen to a lot of artists now, like the flow still sounds the same.
Yeah.
That's one thing about Bay Area artists, you can always tell because they have this particular type of flow that it's not like any other region that you can go to.
Absolutely. And the slang and the everything, slang. Right.
And that's why, you know, people like 40, people like Short, like a lot of artists get the love that they do because they never switch the style up.
Never
had
to. I remember when 40 came out and everyone was like, what is this? And he stuck with it. He was like, I ain't changing with nobody.
I was one of those dudes too, just because it was kind of fresh and brand new to me, so my brain had to get adjusted to the rhyme style.
And he'd go on to be one of the most like bit on artists.
Probably one of the most original in the game. I mean, not to mention the amount of slang that he gave the hip hop world, so many different that he doesn't get enough credit for.
Yeah.
You know, at one time there was a big thing in the Bay where Snoop was getting a lot of love for a lot of the words he was saying that he got from like 40 and a lot of Bay Area artists.
Yeah, shizzle is a Bay term. Exactly.
And you know, here we are all these years later, and you know, now it doesn't matter. It's not a big deal because the internet kind of helps bring all that together. But if we're really going to pre-internet times, it was easy to get away with that type of stuff because you wasn't getting the exposure to other regions so that people in their region could kind of make that claim like, well, I'm the first, or You know, I'm the originator. Now you can't fake that kind of stuff.
No, not at all. But I agree with you. I think I argue that this album, actually, I give it probably 3.5 back then. Actually, this album in over time, it's aged very well.
Yeah.
And I give it probably four mics now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And highly suggest if you guys only know the singles, go back and check the record out. Forte is a way better rapper than you think he is.
Yeah, don't judge just by the singles that were out there, because, you know, that's kind of like a radio, kind of toned down type of songs that he had to put out because he wanted to get radio airplay.
And that was the whole game back then, is everyone needed a radio track, a music video track.
Yeah.
So you had to have something radio friendly. He just did it a lot smarter.
Yeah.
You know, that with Players Club sampling Private Number, and then I'll Be Around. Like, he knew what he was doing. He knew what he was doing.
Like, if you was to take what he did back then and kind of implement it in what you have to do today,
right,
I still think the outcome would be the same, just because of the hustler mentality.
Right.
They weren't industry bred. You know, if we're going back then, like, there weren't budgets. You know, people were literally, like, hustling just to pay for their studio time. You know, it wasn't like labels were coming in with these million-dollar budgets like they are now. Back then, you really had to hustle for yours. So if you was to take that work ethic, that hustler mentality, and then you kind of implement it in today's structure, I'm pretty sure they would be game to how the streaming world works, and definitely some of their YouTube channels would be popping.
Yeah.
It's just they was only able to work with what they had back then.
Right.
But maximizing the output of everything they was able to use. Yeah.
So we listened to two artists that were kind of like homegrown artists, guys that were using more independent, lot of lower budget with their production. Now we're going to one of the biggest budgeted producers in the Bay at that time. It's Ant Banks.
Man.
We're going to move over to Oaktown. And Oakland, of course, legendary. It's the first area to blow up. It's the first area in the Bay that had notable artists. Digital Underground, Too Short, MC Hammer, Tupac, Delta Funky Homo Sapien.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then we had groups like Oaktown 357.
It's not a... Forget Saphir and Hobo Junction,
Saphir
too.
Saphir and Hobo Junction. Yep. And we had mentioned earlier Richie Rich, Dangerous Dame, and everybody. But I don't know if Ant Banks gets his due. I feel like he's totally forgotten. At one point, he was like the Dr. Dre of the Bay.
Seriously.
And he's totally kind of discarded now. And, you know, after he did the TWDY, right?
Yeah.
He did his project, The Whole Damn Yay, with Forte and Captain Save'em. He kind of disappeared. And it's sad that he doesn't
really
get more props.
There was one album. There was an artist from Louisiana. His name's Clint Black.
Oh.
Ant Banks produced, I want to say that album came out 97, 98, but Ant Banks produced a lot on that album, so he didn't totally disappear. I think he just went off and
he was just doing his own
thing.
I looked up his production credits, and he was doing like tracks here and there for people
all
the way to now,
but
releasing no more records. I think he was just done with a
nothing like
on
that
himself.
That Dangerous Crew album,
man,
that came out, like, that's his signature sound over that
these
whole
guys
album.
Were so hard, man.
Yeah.
And so this album was called The Big Badass. It was the sophomore album of Anthony Banks. It was released June 14th, 1994 on Jive Records. You know, Ant was a musical kid growing up. He actually played multiple instruments in the school band. And then combine that with going home and then playing Parliament, Funkadelic, and the Gap Band tracks on keyboard.
Yeah.
So he had a really wide palette of classical music as well as the funk.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You can definitely hear it in his music. He got to start with MC Ant. Remember MC Ant?
Oh, wow.
So MC Ant released an album called The Great in 88.
Wow.
And that was like a album that was kind of big in the Bay.
Yeah,
and
it was.
Released another album called The Comeback in 91. Shout out MC Ant. Super dope artist, does not get his problems.
That was literally, you bring up that song.
Yeah.
Like, I moved to Hawaii in 88. And that's literally, I remember that song coming out here. Because I came out here with like a handful of stuff. that I was playing in the Bay that I was trying to turn people onto out here. But at that time, everybody was just so in love with the DOC album.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Couldn't tell anybody nothing about anything until they started hearing Hammer. And then, you know, that's for really taking it back. Aloha Tower used to do high school dances. They was always playing Hammer and stuff at the dances. Right. So that's when I started learning like how local people really had a knowledge for Bay Area music.
Yeah.
I didn't care how they knew.
Yeah, it's the fact that they just knew.
The fact that they knew.
What's going on.
This is at the time when like Yo MTV Raps wasn't really playing Bay Area artist videos. Like they were kind of just really sticking to what would get them views and stuff. Oh man, I heard what you was just about to play.
We're gonna play it. We're gonna play
it. Oh my gosh. Sometimes it's just the first note gets you, yo.
We're gonna play it, but a lot of people don't remember that. And Banks really got his start with Spice One. That's his biggest artist at that time. That's what got him introduced to the Dangerous Crew.
Was it the Ghetto Has No Heart?
He did 187 Proof, and he did In My Neighborhood. And then he did that song "Gotta Beat a Bomb" from Dangerous Dame in '92.
Oh yes,
fire!
Yeah,
that was a fire song.
Yeah.
And then he would link up with Too Short, which I think would define his career for a good decade.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So he would produce that seventh album, "Shorty the Pimp," in '92.
Oh man.
In the trunk, classic song.
You know, it's really let's go. DJ Premier had a remix to "In the Trunk," and was only on the cassette maxi single. And the instrumental was on that too.
We played it on our '92 show.
Oh my gosh!
Oh yeah.
Yo.
And
so classic.
And then Ant Banks released his debut album, "Sitting on Something Fat," in '93. And you remember that one? That was big in the Bay.
Yes, it was.
It peaked at number 22 on a Billboard rap album chart.
Yes.
So Banks was getting there. And then Big Badass was actually his biggest selling album of his career. It debuted at number 10 on Billboard rap album charts.
Yeah, even at that time, you were starting to see a lot of Bay Area artists climbing on the hip hop charts. You know, they wasn't coming in debuting at the bottom. It was coming in debuting like either in the middle or close to the top. Which really speaks to the support at that time for great music when they wanted to label stuff being regional at that time, and stuff like this was just breaking barriers. And crossing over into other markets, which was, you can't undersell how much of an achievement it was at that time with no internet. Everything was just word of mouth.
100%.
You know?
So, yeah, he released that song Parlayin' with Goldie. Goldie was used to be called Misani back in the day. You remember Misani?
Oh, these names are ringing bells right now.
And that was the first song I played when we came in. This is Clowning with the Crew. This is the posse cut on it. It's got Rappin' Ron and Diddly Dog on it. Got Father Dom on it. Too Short. So, you know, I feel like in Ant Banks, I'll say this right now, he's never put out a bad album.
No.
Never put out a bad album.
Not one whack project.
No. Now, I gotta ask you, in the kind of the history of Bay Area producers, I'm gonna throw out some names. All right, Shock G, DJ Darryl, Studio Ton, Mike Mosley, Tone Capone, EA Ski.
EA Ski's a good one.
Johnny Z, I mean Black C. I mean, where do you feel Ant Banks stands in?
I mean, I'd put him at the top, just. And not because of how good he is, but because of the amount of people that he worked with.
Right.
Because he kind of helped mold a Bay Area sound. You know, like L.A. had their sound. New York had their sound. The Bay Area had its own particular type of sound, which was real funky.
Right.
Real hardcore drums. Damn near boom bap kind of drums, but still had a West Coast bounce to it.
Yeah, and they had that funky bass lines. That's what to me defined Oakland.
Yeah.
Is that funky bass lines.
Yeah.
I mean.
So I put Ant Banks like right at the top. I said, just based off of all the people that he's worked with. And, you know, he was an artist himself.
Right.
So you know, you can't undersell that.
I think Shock, yeah, for Oakland producers, Shock G and Amp Banks is like right up there. They're right up there, you know.
Yeah.
So what do you think? It was unclear. The source only gave this 3 mics. And I'm still like blown away that they gave this album 3 mics.
Yeah, it should have been higher than that, because
all right.
Especially because we're how many decades past the release, and we're listening to it like I could put this next to so many of the now music that's out.
Right.
And this could hold its weight 10 times over. You know, so that for me is incredible, talking about projects like this. You know, if we're really trying to show our age today.
exactly.
I could take music from when I was a youngin, and then let's take what the youngins listen to now, and we could put it side by side and compare. And it'd probably be neck and neck if you was to, you know, if we're talking lyrics, to production, to sonically. I mean, you know, nowadays a lot of people focus on so much extra stuff with the music, but back then, like, people hearing this back then, like, you know, they look at stuff like, oh, they made it, you know, because the sound, having your stuff mastered back then, you cannot undersell that. A lot of people don't understand the difference between just having a great mix and then having it mastered. And a lot of Bay Area artists figured that out.
Absolutely.
Back then, when, okay, we can just sell hood tapes and put it in the trunk,
right,
or we can get this stuff in Tower Records,
right,
or any major outlet that was selling music at that time. Y'all don't know what Tower Records is, so we're giving a lot of history lessons,
you know,
today.
The irony is, it's like, so like Amp Banks, Two Short Guys, they're signed to major labels, they're getting the distribution nationwide, but they aren't getting paid as much.
No.
Which is totally like the messed up thing about the industry, is like you get the exposure and you may get sales, but you're not getting the royalty as releasing it independently.
And that's the gift and the curse at the time, because, you know, the music industry back then, they were banking so much on artists coming in and having no knowledge about the game. So it was real easy to take advantage of artists back then with the type of deals they were signing, because the mystique was you get on a major label, boom, everything's set for you. And in actuality, a lot of the artists, they ended up owing
big time,
and falling in,
or being stuck in a contract and being
that they
stuck
can't get out
and can't release music.
And,
you know,
if we're talking Jive Records in particular, here's the bad side to a Jive, because Jive Records was giving out bad deals to artists. Just ask Q-Tip if you ever want to know.
Yeah. Record company people are shady. That's right. All right, so continuing on, The Big Badass, I highly recommend it. I probably give it 3.5 back then. I'd give it 4 now. I think it's a solid album, and I think it's my favorite Amp Banks album of his catalog. I think that's my favorite. Sticking to Oaktown, we're moving on to the Pimp Supreme.
Drew Down.
Now, Daniel James is his name. This album, Explicit Game, was released September 6, 1994 on Relativity Records.
Man.
And a lot of people are going, well, I thought this was his debut. Well, it was his major label debut.
Yeah.
But technically, this was his second record, because he came out with Fools from the Street in 93. And that's what actually got him the record deal.
Cult classic.
So I still think this is his sophomore album. I'm going to put it in as a sophomore album myself.
I would say that too.
And so I remember picking up Fools from the Street in 93. Got the one copy of Tower Records, Pro Kai. And I was like, who is this guy? He's got a great voice.
Yeah.
This was an Amp Banks produced track, Pimp of the Year, which was his biggest hit.
Major hit.
And, you know, what's an important part of Drew Down's legacy is he introduced the world to the Looney Tunes, at that time.
Right.
And Fools from the Street was technically a Drew Down in the Loonies album. I mean, they're on almost every other track.
Right.
And they came out with a classic, Bay Area classic, called The Ice Cream Man. And
there's a lot of history behind this song.
Oh, yeah? Were they really driving around in an ice cream truck?
Well, this is where the Master P beef.
Oh yeah, like play. Master P jacked this, called a whole album Ice Cream Man.
Exactly. So it was like a real big thing in the Bay for a minute.
Was it Oakland versus Richmond at that point?
No, it was.
Oh wow.
It was. Like you had to been there at the time, because I technically wasn't there. I just still had a lot of homies back home, but this was like probably one of the first major rap beefs in the Bay, other than Hieroglyphics and Saphir, just because the title Ice Cream Man was being floated around.
Yeah. And you remember that wild the graffiti, the condom with
yes,
the Uzis?
Yes.
The condom
yes,
and the Uzis?
Yes. Yes.
It was wild.
But I mean, because that's hip hop has always been like that. So, you know, you're always going to have beef. You're always going to have rappers that don't agree with each other. And, you know, all the hip hop beef, they're always associated with what happened in New York and stuff like that.
Right.
This kind of like was, you know, our culture, our beef at that time in the Bay. And it birthed a lot of great music, though.
Right.
There were a lot of diss tracks that were going back and forth. And a lot of people gravitated towards it, you know, kind of like, if we're going to compare it to like the whole Roxanne series,
yeah.
where they were just dissing back and forth, right. back and forth.
With this, UTFO and like,
so,
Roxanne.
So Looney's really like took that extra step as far as notoriety because of the beef they kept having with P at that time.
See, I didn't even know about this. That's totally regional stuff that I never even heard of. I just remember, you know, knowing this song first, and then Master P coming out with the Ice Cream Man album, and going like, okay, what? But it's not like Master P was putting out original music anyway. He was jacking all kind of people's hooks, and I mean, he literally put out that High for Christmas EP, and you remember that one? And he jacked the Bone Thugs beat, and he like. So, I think what Master P was just trying to do is he always knew he wasn't the best rapper. He always knew that he wasn't like a musician. He was a businessman.
I was just about to say that. And fast forward to this day, the fact that his relevancy in the game, let's not undersell that.
No.
You know, Nori always likes to say, give people their flowers while they're here. That's one particular dude. A lot of rappers nowadays can learn literally just from where he began to where he's at now, and all the in between, whether you want to call him a sellout because he was doing
and he was doing the Hotline and the clothes
exactly
and,
like
yeah.
But if we're just talking about business, there's a dude that really has shown that outside of music, where hip-hop can take you as far as being a mogul.
Right. Talk about investing in yourself and investing in your family with Silk and Seymour. I mean, come on now. Like
at that time, because he took that independent hustle that you get in the Bay, and he kind of just brought that to the mainstream more than anybody else had, you know. Like, Hammer probably could have did that if he never signed with a major.
Yeah.
I just don't think he would have got the worldwide notoriety if he wasn't on a major.
That's right.
But, you know, because this is when hip-hop really started exploding in the country. All the negativity it was getting, and you know, at that time, you know, they didn't care what kind of press. It was like, if people are talking about it, it's gonna be the shit. So at that particular time, there was so much people talking about what was going on in the Bay, because it was so many artists starting to get major label deals.
Right.
Even low people on the totem pole was getting major label deals. So that just goes to show.
94 was the year where the record label execs and talent scouts all flooded the Bay.
Yeah.
Everybody got signed. JT got signed. Yep. Drew Down got signed. Yep. Robin Ford, they got signed. Everybody got signed. Everyone that was notable got signed.
Yep.
And with Drew Down, you know, Drew Down was, again, guys were looking for people with unique voices, doesn't sound nothing like him. No one sounded like Drew Down at that time. So I'm going to give you a little background on Drew Down. A lot of people don't know that his name was originally Droopy. That was his name in the streets, was Droopy, Droopy Dog. And he started off as a street hustler. He was a dope dealer, you know, he was pimping. And started rapping in the late 80s.
Right.
And then he hooked up with Chris Hicks, who was the gentleman on the album cover with the long hair. And it was always like, they both were sporting those perms, those crazy wavy Those wavy perms.
A lot of chicks were jealous because their hair was flowing back right. there. Yo.
He had the perms that was fighting. Exactly, like, the gold teeth, the perms. Like, it was wild. Like, nobody right. looked like him.
Right.
He was truly original right. artist. And now the internet rumor is, I don't know if you ever heard this, is that he's the illegitimate son of Bootsy Collins. His mom used to
fool around with
Bootsy back in the day. I don't know if this is confirmed. He's joked about it in interviews, and so has Bootsy.
Wow.
And they did a song together called Baby Bubba in like 96.
Now that you say that, like, but, I can't unsee
But they
unsee
joke
that.
About it all the time, enough where it, and, you know, Drew's father's never around, and his mom used to fool around with Bootsy. I mean, hey, you never know. But I think that rumor's great. I say stick with it. Go with it, man.
Ride that to the end of time, yo.
Related to Bootsy Collins, ride that train, right?
That's royalty right there.
So, you know, the ice cream man that we talked about earlier introduced Yuck Mouth and Numbskull.
Yep.
And you know, the album sold well.
Yep.
It built up a lot of hype for... Do you remember what the second single was? It was a very R&B-ish. It was called No One Loves You.
Oh, yeah,
sampled
yeah.
SOS Band.
That's right.
This is SOS Band
That's
sample.
Right. That's right.
Now, the thing is, for me personally, with Drew Down, I felt his best tracks are with the Loonies. And his best chemistry was with them.
Yeah.
I knew that they weren't going to go in a group form, but I really wish they did.
Yeah.
I think it would have been beneficial. I mean, the Loonies obviously took off the following year when I Got Five on it.
Yeah.
And they let him lead off the track.
Yeah.
So, you know, he'll always be an icon for starting off one of the best Bay Area remixes of all time.
Now, a lot of people I knew too shared the same sentiment because, you know, at that time, like, compilations and you know, people doing stuff together, you were seeing that in the Bay. You wasn't really seeing that too much outside in other regions.
Right.
Like collaborations, one person from one crew collaborating with another crew or people coming together. It would have been interesting to see from a creative standpoint.
Right.
Not to say their styles would clash, but, you know, they weren't just spitting a bunch of nonsense. Like, people knew how to write songs too, regardless of the topic they were saying.
Yeah.
But the songwriting was good. Like, that's why you can listen to this stuff now and it still has that feel to it.
Right.
Even though the relevancy is, you know, to the times back then.
Yeah.
But if you're a fan of the art and the music, you know, look past the production, look past the mixing and the mastering, and look at the songwriting, the bar structure,
right.
Hooks, melodies in the hooks. A lot of hip-hop artists weren't really doing too many melodies and hooks back then. So when people say the Bay Area birthed a lot of what hip-hop culture is today, you can reference back to a lot of stuff you've been playing throughout this whole session we've been talking and take key elements in those songs and study it in a way to where, you know, how people love to study Motown and people love to study the funk era and jazz.
Right.
Just understand the artistry in a whole, in its entirety, and appreciate it because some of the best work that's people are underselling how great it is. Seriously, I'm glad we're talking about this.
Yeah, man. So the source would give this album 3.5 mics. I actually like the Fools from the Street version better. It's harder. It's more hard-edged.
Yeah.
They obviously would have to put songs like this as like radio singles and music videos. We talked about the politics of it, you know. And but I still think it's a solid album. I probably give it 3 mics now. Personally,
I mean, at that time, you got to look at who was rating.
Right.
You know, because if we're talking the source, like, that's just all East Coast bias.
Right.
That's
they weren't giving too much love to Bay.
No, there wasn't. Even to L.A. too. That's why a lot of people in Cali, you know, they love reading the source, but they hated it at the same time because of the biasness. And they always talk down to West Coast music when at that time the West Coast was really starting to rise.
That was the peak of
West
Coast.
It was undeniable.
Influence.
Yes, exactly.
So, anyways, shout out Drew Down. He would actually go on to release 6 more solo albums between 96 and 2019. The guy's still working. He's still out there.
Yes.
Now, going on to our last Oakland group that we're going to be talking about is a group that I don't think a lot of younger people have ever heard of. It's Raw Fusion.
Oh my gosh.
And The album is called Hoochified Funk. And this was the sophomore album. This album is extremely hard to find. Right now, it's like...
I've never had this album, by the way.
I don't think a lot of people had this album. I had it on cassette.
Bootleg cassettes,
CD was extremely hard to find. Yeah. And I think the reason why that was is because the album was released in 94 on Hollywood Basic. And if you remember Hollywood Basic, it was a label that was owned by Disney. And it was where hip-hop artists went to die. Yeah. So Organized Confusion was the biggest group on Hollywood Basic at the time.
Yeah.
And then they had another guy's, the Lifers group. You remember the Lifers group?
Wow, yes,
which was all the convict rappers.
Yes.
And they actually recorded that in prison. They brought like the studio to the jail.
Yeah. That's why it sounded the way
wild.
It did.
Oh, so Raw Fusion is a side project of Digital Underground.
Yeah.
It was the joint venture of Money B and DJ Fuse of Digital Underground.
Yep.
Now, I love that first album, Live at Steelatron.
Yes.
And you had Rockin' to the AM on it, you had Throw Your Hands in the Air.
Yes.
Those videos got Yo MTV Raps City airplay.
They did.
And then most people know Money B from I Get Around. His verse on Tupac's second album.
Yep.
And that big single. But what's your thoughts on Raw Fusion? They just, you know, like they had a little bit of a moment in 91 with that first album.
Yeah.
Then this album just completely disappeared.
I think at that time, this is when we're starting. It was an over influx. You know, the fact that a lot of people were getting deals, so you started to see how watered down the material started to get in a way. It's because people were just being thrown out here left and right. Like, was industry wanted to see what stuck.
Yeah.
You're wrestled.
Yeah.
You're trying to upgrade from just regional.
Right.
Now you're trying to go cross over into the mainstream and national. So some of the Bay Area artists, you know, that's why some of the music maybe wasn't as how it should, because they were trying to reach that level of success instead of staying true to what got them there in the first place. But that album in particular,
that first album's like, that's a low-key Bay Area classic.
Like, cult
album for
real
sure.
Cult classic. The fact that it's so rare and hard to get
speaks
to how much of a cult classic it is. I don't even think you can find a lot of that stuff on YouTube.
No, actually, even for the Hoochified Funk, you can only find maybe 5 tracks off the album. The rest is gone. The only way you can get this album is on eBay.
And how much is it on eBay?
and it's wild. Like, and also, like, you got a CD player to play that thing in on, right? You know, so it's... You know, it's unfortunate because I think Money B is a better rapper than people remember him to be.
No, exactly.
And Money B, I don't think really got his due either. And I just... I loved him as an artist, and I just wanted to see him more. And just I think maybe after, they got label jacked by Hollywood Basic.
Yeah.
And neither of these albums even got released. They're on no streaming platform, nothing.
Yeah.
Maybe he just got disillusioned with the business and was just like, forget it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, even at that time, you know, people that rose to the top.
Right.
The fall off, you know, for a lot of them was even greater. Just because, you know, they build you up, and then once you can't do nothing for them, and the labels are just like, you know,
they chew you up, spit you out, and I think that's probably what happened to them. The Source actually reviewed this album; they gave it 3 mics. I can't even speak on it because I've never listened to the. I've had the cassette, but
I've only
remember
one song.
I lost it, and I can't remember it. So I remember kind of enjoying it. I remember not enjoying it nowhere near as much as Steelatron. Steelatron was the record.
Yeah, I think at this time, like, a lot of the steam was out of the sails, because they were, from what I remember, a lot of folks telling me they were trying to break the group up.
Right.
They were trying to make Shock G go solo because he was producing.
And he's had some hits. Yeah.
And then, you know, Money B was kind of like the odd man out of the clique, because Tupac, you know, did what Tupac did.
Yeah, Tupac had exploded at that point.
So he just totally transcended, totally beyond the group.
Yeah, it was sad. By the time he did Me Against the World, you know, Pac wasn't even working with Shock G at that point. He had moved on to all these other producers at that point. And then Death Row was right around the corner.
But Money B... literally the last surviving original member of Digital Underground. He's put out music.
He had singles here and there, solo singles here and there, but everything independently and nothing really getting any kind of airplay or anything, you know. So shout out to Money B, man, and again, rest in peace to Shock G. As we move on to our last album of the day, we go to the V-Town. Any memories about Vallejo at all? Because Vallejo is that's a wild town, man.
Vallejo. I mean, I could say a lot of things about Vallejo. The one thing that stands out the most, and it's not a real positive comment, it makes me feel bad, but Vallejo at one point in time was, I want to say, the first city to claim bankruptcy in California. So when you listen to E40, a lot of artists that come out of Vallejo and listen to their music, hear the struggle, hear the pain in their songs, understand, like, they go through a lot up there in the northern part of Cali. They're an extended Bay Area family. I could go back to the early 90s where they didn't count anything past Stockton being the Bay Area. Now you can go all the way to Sac and they kind of incorporate like the whole region as a whole. But Vallejo has a lot of great artists that have came from there. That hit on a major scale on Billboard.
Yeah.
You know?
E40 and the whole Sick With It crew, and then them getting the distribution deal with Jive. Yep. Really pushed it in. Mac Mall was major. Mac Dre, obviously. You know, so we're going to talk about the first group I ever heard of out of Vallejo, which is N2 Deep.
Yep.
And that's what I'm playing right now. This is the sophomore album, 24/7/365. It was released November 15th, 1994 on Busted Records. Do you remember Busted Records? This was owned by MC Hammer.
Are you serious?
Ironic name, Busted Records.
You just taught me something new today. I did not know that.
Busted Records was owned by MC Hammer. He had signed also Dougie Fresh. At this point, and I don't know if you remember, Dougie Fresh had a 92 album with like a neon blue cover that was kind of like whack, and it was like real dancey, it was real Hammerish, and that was on MC Hammer's label, that was on Busted Records.
That wasn't the album that had All the Way to Heaven on it, the Dougie Fresh album?
It was, I think you might be right, but it was on Busted Records.
Because there were a lot of danceable kind of tracks on that Dougie album.
They were trying to reinvent Dougie Fresh as kind of like
not just a beatbox dude.
So the story of how they actually got on this record label was, you know, basically they had released their first album in 91, or 92, excuse me, Back to the Hotel.
Yeah.
And the album exploded, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And made it to number 14 on the Billboard charts.
Yeah, that single was major.
First Vallejo artist to go gold, which was wild. And then MC Hammer actually approached them for management, and it was Busted Management.
Wow.
And then in 93, Profile Records was going through ownership and all this kind of different Profile was getting like approached by other labels to be bought.
Right.
And then they dropped the group because it just was in the middle of everything. And then Busted Records was like, oh, we'll put the album out. And which was good because they were able to get an album out, but bad because they had no marketing budget and they couldn't push anything. And so the album got lost in a mix, and really no one outside of the Bay really heard this album. Or even knew N2 Deep had a follow-up.
Yeah.
So,
but even at that time, like, the accomplishment for Latin artists.
Right.
To hit, and, you know, if we're talking back then, like, the hip-hop culture was, you know, keep it real, like, it was just black people. Anybody else outside of that coming into the culture was kind of viewed not in a great way.
I mean, what did we have at that time? We had a Lighter Shade of Brown, Kid Frost. I mean, you know,
didn't have much to
and
really.
And Latin groups weren't really expanding outside of the Latin community.
Yeah, yeah.
Gerardo.
Can we erase that name?
So, Yeah, like N2 Deep was like Chicano group.
Yeah.
Hard. I mean, let's talk about the members here. Johnny Trulio, aka JT, that's the heart of the group.
Yeah.
You got Timothy Lyons, aka TL.
Yeah.
And then you got Johnny Zunio, aka Johnny Z, who I think is a super underrated Vallejo producer.
Yeah.
I love that first N2 Deep album.
Oh yeah.
With you know Toss Up and The Weeknd and. It was just that album came out of nowhere.
You could not ride anywhere in the state of Hawaii
without hearing
Back to the Hotel. Yo.
Waikiki Strip.
Oh my gosh.
All in Moana Beach Park.
Every Sunday. Every Friday and Saturday when you know it's hard for people to imagine this, but traffic was so bad in Waikiki, it literally took an hour. Just to get from Fort DeRussy and do a loop round one time.
Right.
And literally, there could be 1,000 cars, 999 of them are playing N2 Deep Back to the Hotel.
You know, it's like, it's just sad that, you know, there wasn't loyalty amongst hip hop fans at that time to follow these guys.
Yeah.
I just feel like if you guys ever listen to this album, check this album. This album's way better than you remember it to be. And like, this is Count My Bank. Like,
they gave you a little bit of everything. There was lyricism on that album too.
They could rap.
Yeah.
They had the dance tracks.
Yep.
They had like the mobbing songs. Yep. You had the riding in the car songs. Yep. I mean,
it was well rounded.
It was a well rounded album. The album was big in Vallejo.
Yeah.
And big in the Bay, but not outside of that. I would talk to friends and I was like, N2 Deep got a new album. They're like, what? Like, they didn't even know about it.
Wow.
You know, so, and they would go on to release 5 more albums.
Yeah.
You know, until 2008 when they broke up and JT would go solo. But it's just sad that you had an iconic single and, again, no loyalty as far as. I just feel like a major label took a chance on them. I think they could have had a longer run.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because. If you look at now to where there are no color lines in music, so it doesn't matter who's who, your path that you could take won't be so skewered as back then. You had to have a certain image,
right?
Especially certain producers,
right.
You know, there were a lot of variables that kind of brought the project down from being where it should have been. But like I said, man, you still can't understand back then in the 90s. Any hip-hop artist that wasn't black at that time. Because even, like, for white MCs,
right.
You know, they were just shunning them when there was a lot of great talent. You know, I'm just glad we're so progressed all these decades later to where we're not looking at, you know, the color of somebody. You're judging them by the music and how great it is.
Yeah.
You know, I guess you could say back then kind of was on that snail's pace to get to where we are now.
These guys were trailblazers, I mean, in a lot of ways. I mean, they also discovered Baby Bash, because Baby Bash was part of Patna Deuce. Remember Patna Deuce?
Oh my gosh.
So, yeah. Hopefully you'll come back and do another Bay Area episode with me. And we're going to chop it up about more Bay Area albums. But I just want to give one last shout out to N2 Deep, because way better group than anybody remembers it to be in there.
No, seriously. You know,
and they get dismissed as a one-hit wonder. But if you go back, I'd say go back and listen to this album. Go back and listen to any of their like early albums.
Yeah,
they're dope, man. They're actually really great.
Like if you're a fan, not just of hip hop music in general, but of things that help birth this culture. You know, everybody will go to like Sugar Hill and say, oh no, you know, that helped birth the hip hop culture.
Right.
For the West Coast at that particular time, where they just wanted to associate Cali with LA, the Bay Area put out so many great artists with great albums, and they've had stuff since the 80s. Because, you know, I can remember middle school and starting high school, you know, we knew Freaky Tales in 86.
Right.
You know, we knew Hammer Ringham in 86. By the time the rest of the country got to hear it, it was already, I'm not going to say it's played out, but It was already been ran through for hella years.
You guys had to do what you like before everyone else.
Seriously. So at that time, like, to the fight up, the uphill battle that a lot of Bay Area groups and artists and producers had to take at that time, and then to place on Billboard, to be known nationally, like, you cannot undersell how much of an accomplishment that is. That'll be the equivalent, you know, like, you get 1 billion streams on Spotify right today. You know, if you want to compare something to bring it to the relevancy of today. And mind you, back then, they were just doing it with word of mouth, literally pulling up to different neighborhoods out the trunk of their car with cassettes.
Right.
You know, like, if they had the internet back then, I can only imagine the explosion that would have took place, way more than what it did in the 90s for literally just the tools that any artist back then had to work with.
100%.
You know, so while you're listening to all the songs, you know, Cameron's playing today, really go do some research on a lot of this music. And it's not to go give them some streams or, you know, generate revenue for them, but
part of history.
Exactly.
It's a part of hip hop history.
This is the part that a lot of people don't do. Yep. They won't do their due diligence in studying the history. And you know, you don't gotta be a fan of a certain region to go in and study the history of a lot of their artists from there. Just learn how the hustle and their work ethic and stuff that they had to do, and you could take notes from that and apply it to what you gotta do 100%. Today.
This is the whole reason why we started this show was to basically, hopefully, some younger people may listen to this, hopefully, and see that there's an evolution of hip-hop music and how it is important to, you know, really honor the forefathers of the genres.
Yep.
And because some of the artists that they listen to, they may not, like directly say that I've been influenced by them, but they're indirectly influenced by them. I mean, 100%. I mean, so I think that's hip-hop's still the only genre that the new artists don't give props to the older artists.
I have these conversations all the time, even with said younger people. But then it takes me back to when, you know, I'm that age, teens, early 20s. Did I really care about stuff my parents were listening to? Did I really want to go study Motown and all that? So, you know, I won't say a generational gap, but, you know, people are just naturally not gonna wanna, like, go do research.
Right.
Doesn't matter that you got Google and you could ask any question on Google and you got an answer. You know, you don't gotta hit an encyclopedia. You don't gotta go to the library and go research news clippings or none of that. You know, y'all don't know that struggle. Okay.
100%.
Nowadays, like, you can just bring up any information. So that's why it kind of, like, bugs me out when people are so turned off and don't want to do it. When it's just a simple, you type something and bam, you got the whole history of whatever at your fingertips. But people just want to stay clueless. I don't know why. But you can learn a lot.
100%. Even by just listening to an album. Even just by listening to something. And trying to picture the region, the area.
Exactly.
It tells a story on itself.
Let's not wait till these artists are dead and then they go viral on the internet. And then that makes you want to go research and understand what they are. Like, do it now. And you might actually learn. And then you might pick up on shit that might be in your regular rotation on your playlist.
Right.
Garon motherfucking T.
Drama, I really appreciate you coming in
all day.
You let me nerd out on all this music.
Oh man, and you take, like, my skin is wrinkled from being in this hot tub time machine for so long.
Well, I hope you come back and talk some more hip hop with me.
Can you come back, Drama? Is that can
there you
do
go?
It?
You're feeling for Aaron. He's so tired.
Can you?
Whenever the bat signal gets put up.
Oh, yeah. You heard it here. And once again, thank you guys for tuning in. This is Sky Cameron. I'm with DJ Drama. And rest in peace, Shock G.
Oh, man. I'm tired of losing the greats. What are they leaving us with? That's all I want to say. You keep taking the good ones, and then what are you leaving?